May it please the court, my name is Ruchi Kapoor, regulation number 42998. I represent the appellant Darrell Askew in this case. Seated to my right at counsel table is co-counsel Anthony Noble on this brief. Your Honor, the issue in this case is that the evidence presented at trial is insufficient to support Mr. Askew's conviction for failure to register as a sex offender. Mr. Askew was convicted under section 183.412.51A. This subsection makes a broad reference to Article 22 of Title 16, and in Halbert v. People, another division of this court found that subsection 1A does not incorporate all of the duties in Article 22 of Title 16. The division found that this subsection is specifically violated only if the defendant, 1, did not initially register at all, 2, did not register with the right law enforcement agency, or 3, did not register within 5 days of release from incarceration or receiving notice to register, 4, did not confirm his registration, or 5, did not re-register within 5 days of his or her birthday. The evidence presented at trial in this case did not establish that Mr. Askew failed to complete any one of these 5 acts. At trial, it was established that Mr. Askew was originally required to register as a sex offender after a juvenile adjudication. He filled out his registration paperwork in December 2012 and stated that he was registering as homeless in the paperwork and that his current address was a Walmart parking lot on Platt and Arowana Street. In January 2013, Mr. Askew helped a few of his friends move into a new residence on Mark Shuffle Road. While he was helping them move, they let him stay with them. And it was unclear from the evidence presented at trial how long he stayed. It was somewhere between 14 to 20 days. While he was staying with his friends as they moved in, he stayed on the couch, he did not pay rent, and he did not move any of his belongings into the house. Once his friends were finished moving, they asked Mr. Askew to leave. And on February 9th, he was pulled over for a routine traffic stop. During that stop, the officer saw that Mr. Askew's last known address was homeless. And when told by Mr. Askew that he was living with his grandmother on Mark Shuffle Road, the police officer began to investigate. None of this evidence presented at trial shows that Mr. Askew failed to do any of the 5 things required by subsection 1A, as interpreted by the court in Halbert. And taking the evidence presented as a whole and in the light most favorable to the prosecution did not present a violation of subsection 1A. Therefore, the evidence was insufficient to support a finding beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Askew is guilty of failing to register as a sex offender pursuant to section 412.51A. And we request the court to vacate the conviction in this case.
Ms. Kapoor, let me ask you this. The charge that was rendered was based on 183.412.51A. Court suggested at the time of discussions concerning an election that the conduct really fit 412.51G, if I recall correctly.
That's right.
All right. Had the prosecution accepted that and said, yes, that is the subsection we're proceeding on, would the evidence have been sufficient?
I'm not really sure, Your Honor. I mean, it could have been, but I think it just depends on whether or not how the district court interpreted subsection G and applied it to the facts in this case. That's not what happened in this case. The district attorney never changed the charging subsection from 1A to 1G. So because the district attorney chose to proceed under 1A instead of G, it's clear that there was insufficient evidence presented at trial.
So your position, though, requires that we interpret the statute at issue here in the same way that the Halbert Division did, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. If we don't agree with the Halbert Division, then what?
Then we would request the court to interpret it pursuant to the Pulangi court's reasoning in this case. Their reasoning was they didn't actually apply 1A in Pulangi. But in that case, the court's reasoning was that each subsection of 412.51 is a separate violation, and so each subsection represents a different crime. So I would request the court to apply the statutory interpretation, to interpret the statute to read the plain language and apply it to the facts that represent the trial in this case.
So either case reaches the same result.
That's correct.
Defendant was clearly on notice of what he was charged with doing, correct?
Yes.
So through the discovery and everything, he understood that it was his failure to register a change of address.
That's correct.
So there wasn't any surprise or anything that was asserted at trial, at least as I read the record.
No, as the trial attorney put it, when arguing the motion for election, it was that subsection 1A was being treated as a catch-all by the prosecution's notice of election, the theory of the case, and they didn't match. So what the trial attorney was requesting was that the prosecution clarify how it was choosing to proceed or the theory of the case. So I think I think that answers your question. I think it's just,
well, here's another question then. As I read the record, defense counsel sort of acknowledged that subsection 1A was a catch-all. Do you agree with that or not?
I don't think defense counsel was acknowledging 1A as a catch-all. I think that was prior to the division's reasoning in Halbert. So when she was acknowledging that 1A kind of served as
she
a heading.
She served as a heading for the other subsections.
I think her language in saying that it served as a heading, I think she was kind of thinking that, because she hadn't found Pelagi yet. That hadn't been brought to the court's attention when she stated that either. So, I mean, in Pelagi, it was clear that the court was interpreting. Pelagi left that question open, whether or not 1A was a total catch-all. So I'm not sure whether defense counsel's acknowledgement that it was a 1A is. I think in her argument to the court, she clarified that she wasn't acknowledging that 1A was a total catch-all, but was instead stating that it penalized a specific number of actions. If you continue to read the argument as it happened during jury instructions.
One other question. If but your opponent says it was invited error by virtue of the way the defense counsel below argued the issue, what's your position on that?
Well, Your Honor, it wasn't invited error because defense counsel didn't actually concede that 1A was a catch-all. This was actually rectified by the fact that trial counsel brought up the issue to the court again during the sentencing hearing after Halbert had been published. So even if it was invited error, I think that the trial court definitely had the ability and was on notice of the error and would have been able to vacate the conviction at that point if it had chosen to follow the Halbert decision.
Well, the argument, though, as I understand it, was that that the defendant should be sentenced to probation, and the argument was in the context of that statement, not that the evidence was insufficient based upon Halbert, even though that was the rationale in Halbert.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I think I think trial counsel was trying to, I think the trial counsel did her job by giving the court notice of the Halbert opinion and its decision. Whether the court's remedy for the error was up to the court.
But the remedy that was asked for was probation. Remedy wasn't, I mean, I didn't see defense counsel asking the court to vacate the conviction.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. I don't think that totally, it's not, the court was still on notice that a mistake had been made at trial. And the court had been on notice of that mistake throughout the proceeding. So it wasn't, it had been raised during pretrial motions, it was raised at jury instructions. So defense counsel's request doesn't negate the need for trial, for the district court to have noticed the mistake and to correct it, And if the court has no further questions, I'd like to reserve my remaining time for a little.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Lisa Michaels, registration number 38949, and I represent the people. There are two key issues in this case, the standard of review and the Halbert case. I'm going to start by talking about the standard of review because I think that's key to resolving this case. And to begin that, I'm going to start by talking about what I think is undisputed in the record. At trial, the defendant argued that the prosecution should be required to elect a specific subsection of 18.3.412.5. Prosecution did not elect a more specific subsection, but did elect a specific act. And that is that the defendant failed to register the additional residence that he established on Mark Shuffle Road. That was the evidence that was presented, and that was the argument that the prosecution made to the jury.
Ms. Michaels, before you proceed ahead, I didn't think it was an additional residence. I thought it was a change of address. The trial court talked about subsection 1G, which is the subsection that deals with change of address. And the prosecutor didn't correct the court and didn't come back even after the trial was complete and say, we're going after an additional residence.
Your Honor, I believe that subsection covers both a change of address and establishing an additional residence. And I can take a look at that if you
go ahead. No, I'll give me a moment. You're talking. Go ahead.
Yes, it does actually include establishing an additional residence. And so, if that answers your question.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Move on. So as I was saying about the record, the defendant did not move for judgment of acquittal or otherwise argue to the court that the evidence was insufficient to prove the charge. But now on appeal, the defendant is arguing that election argument that he made to the trial court preserved the sufficiency claim. But that argument at trial was about unanimity. It wasn't about sufficiency. And moreover, the defendant's position on appeal is inconsistent with his position at trial. At trial, he argued that 412.51A was too broad, so broad that he wanted the prosecution to elect a more specific subsection. Now on appeal, he's arguing that 1A is too specific, so specific that it does not include the conduct that the defendant was charged with. So it's the people's position based on that the defendant's inconsistent positions that his claim is not reviewable at all on appeal. But at the very least, the defendant failed to preserve the sufficiency claim because an objection on one ground at trial does not preserve an objection on a different ground for appeal. So because the defendant failed to preserve that claim, plain error review applies. Now I know that there's a body of case law that indicates that plain error does not apply to sufficiency. But there is a distinction to be drawn there's a distinction to be drawn between when the evidence itself is the problem or when interpretation of the statute, the charging statute, is the issue. And that's the distinction that was drawn in the Locallo case that I cited in my brief. And it makes sense, because in a case where the evidence itself is the problem, if the prosecution fails to prove one or more elements of the charge, that's going to be reversible error. It may not matter in that case, because that's going to be reversible error under any standard. But when we're talking about interpretation of a statute, it does matter if that the interpretation of the statute is not obvious. And this case is a perfect example of that. Because at trial, the prosecution and the trial court did not have the benefit of the Halbert case, which clarified which conduct was covered by 412.51A. And everybody at trial was under the impression that the defendant's conduct was covered under that subsection.
Well, Ms. Miles, a couple of things. First, you don't have to ask for an acquittal to preserve a sufficiency claim. And when you argue to the court, you're charging me under the wrong section, isn't a subset of that sufficiency? Of necessity, it argues sufficiency because it says, you're not choosing the right section to charge me. So I couldn't have violated that section.
I agree with the statement that you made, Judge, but I think the distinction is here, what the defendant wasn't arguing that it was the wrong subsection altogether. What the defendant was saying was that he wasn't saying 1A didn't cover his conduct. He was saying 1A covers it, but we need to know more specifically what you're talking about. So I think it's a little bit different than what you were saying.
The second thing that troubles me is the statement that nobody at trial thought that this was the situation. The trial court did. The trial court invited the prosecutor to charge under 1G. Said, hey, isn't this a 1G case? And the prosecutor refused and said, no, I think we're going to go under 1A.
Okay, well, let me try to answer. I think there's a couple questions in there. I'll try to answer them each. So I think the trial court did suggest 1G. And I do think that 1G would have been appropriate. This is all pre-Halbert. So we're talking about what everybody knew before Halbert, which is, frankly, what we didn't know what 1A covered before Halbert. So I think that pre-Halbert, the prosecution could have charged its conduct under either 1A or 1G. And I think the reason that the prosecution was reluctant to elect a more specific subsection, or 1G in particular, was because, and I think this goes actually directly to the obviousness issue, because the Pope case was out, but I think that Pope, of course, didn't address what 1A covered. And Pope actually penalized the prosecution for electing in that case. Because they made an election, they lost the entire case. They lost the two different types of conduct that were charged. And so I think that actually, I'm trying to get back to remember exactly what your question was, I think that it could have been charged under 1G or 1A, and I think the reason the prosecution refused was because of the Poe case, and they thought that they would be penalized for doing that. They thought it was more proper, again, pre-Halbert, to charge it under 1A. So, and my final point about the obviousness, and I'll get to Halbert momentarily, is that the interpretation that the Halbert court came up with was not obvious before that case was decided. And so because the error...
Some would say it's not even obvious now.
Okay. I can't say I would disagree with that, Judge. So because it wasn't obvious, this case should follow the Locallo case. This case is a great example of why obviousness matters and why plain error should apply, maybe not when we're talking about just evidentiary sufficiency, but when we're talking about the interpretation of the charging statute. Because in a case like this, when it's not obvious, it matters, it makes a difference. The standard of review does make a difference. And so now I'll move on to the Halbert case. In Halbert, as I'm sure your honors are aware, the court interpreted 18.3.4.12.5 and concluded that subsection 1A covered how, when, and where to register, and also re-registration upon a birthday. And the court concluded that, the court got to reach that conclusion by correlating various subsections of 412.5 with various subsections of 1622.108. And with regard to 412.51A, the court said 108, 1 and 2 are the correlating subsections. But the problem is the court skipped 108, 1C. The court went from 108, 1A, 108, 1B, skipped 1C, and then went to 108, 2. And the court didn't give an explanation for why 1C wouldn't be covered under 1A, 412.51A, just like the other subsections of 108.1. Now, if the reason is, as the defendant suggested in the brief, in the reply brief, if the reason is that 1C wasn't pertinent in that case, that reason doesn't apply here, because here it is pertinent. Because here, the conduct that's covered in 1C is establishing an additional residence, and that is what the defendant failed to do here. So this court can follow the Halbert analysis if it chooses to do that and complete it by applying 1C, which is applicable here, and finding that it is included, like the other subsections of 108.1, under 412.51A.
Well, the problem with that, as I see it, is that, as I understand Halbert, is saying that those things in 1622, the whole section from subsection 1 or 0.1 to 15 can be charged if they're not delineated in 183.12.5. And 1C is delineated, as you pointed out, in 183.412.51G. So, as I understand Halbert, that's the rationale, that anything that's in that in 108 can be charged if it's not already set forth in 412.5. What do you think of that?
That wasn't the interpretation that I had, when I went through the analysis and the reasoning, I'm not disagreeing with it, that isn't one that I had, that I was thinking. I was thinking that they correlated kind of the specific, almost directly across, and just left out 1C, and maybe what that point is about is really that the language, if we have it 1C covered in 1G and 1A, then the 1G is superfluous. But, and I agree that of course that is something that the court, we have a preference that when we interpret statutes that we don't have duplicative language. But I think the problem with that is that the legislature specifically included 1C in under 108.1, and we can't ignore that. We can't just say, well, it's meaningless because it's also discussed in 108.3. And so I see your point, but I think the problem is that, again, we just have that problem of 1C being included in 108.1.
Ms. Michael, and I just want to clarify, as I read your brief, one of the main arguments was don't follow Halbert. It's not correctly decided. But are you now saying if we do follow, that this case is still distinguishable and that it would have a different result? Am I understanding your argument?
That's exactly right, because I think the facts here are distinguishable. I mean, this is all kind of similar, but the reason it's distinguishable is because here, the defendant, in Halbert, I think it was clear or more clear that he was changing his address. And here, I think the defendant was establishing an additional address, additional residence. And the reason is because in Halbert, he was kicked out of the house that he was living at. In this situation, the lack of fixed residence status was his original address, if you can call it that. And that he didn't change that. He just added an addition because that remained that was ultimately what he went back to. And I think when you're trying to distinguish the two, really what it comes down to is, can the defendant still be found at that additional address? In Halbert, he was kicked out, so we're not going to find him at that original address. Here, he only stayed at the Mark Shuffle location for 14 to 20 days. So he went back to having, or maybe never ceased having, a lapse of fixed residence as his status.
But in Halbert, though, wasn't there evidence that the defendant returned to that home from which he was supposedly kicked out? In fact, one witness testified that he was so comfortable there, he was watching TV in his undershirt and things of that nature.
Yes, there was evidence of that. But I guess my interpretation of it was that the jury, by the jury convicting of him of of failing to register an address change, that necessarily that evidence wasn't credible or wouldn't be considered in the final outcome, I guess was my interpretation of that. So, Judge Dunn, to answer the question, it is still our position that 1A is the catch-all. But I think if this court wants to follow Halbert, it can follow the reasoning and complete the analysis because it's distinct and find that 1C is applicable under these circumstances, which are distinguishable from those in Halbert. But at the very least, the interpretation that 1C is not included, that 108.1C is not included in 412.51A in Halbert was not obvious. And because of that, any error here was not plain.
What about at sentencing when they brought this to the trial court's attention? I mean, at that point, it is plain and obvious that there's this authority out there that's published. Granted, it has the notation. It's not final.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Yes, I mean, obviously, Halbert was brought to the court's attention, but I think at that point, it was too late. And maybe if the defendant had asked for relief under Halbert, I think then, of course, the court would have been required to do some kind of analysis at that point and could have included in that analysis if it was too late or what can be done at that point. But I think really the critical time to preserve it would have been to raise it at trial and something could have been done about that, about the wrong subsection.
If we take the view that you can raise a sufficiency of the evidence argument at any time, even on appeal for the first time, does that negate your argument? On what kind of review we should exercise?
Well, it negates my argument about plain error, although I'm not sure if you're saying that you would find that the distinction that I was talking about with statutory interpretation isn't...
No, just the plain error issue.
I mean, if you found that no matter what, even in a statutory interpretation situation like this, that plain error doesn't apply, then I think my plain error arguments are out the window. But I still think the court could not follow Halbert and or apply the reasoning from Halbert and find and complete that analysis here where it's distinguishable. Okay. I see that my time is up. So if there are no further questions, I will ask this court to affirm.
Thank you.
Your Honor, as to the plain error versus the de novo review in this case, I would just like to note the court that in Locallo, the division noted that one of the most important reasons for applying plain error review in a case like this would be for alerting the trial court to a particular issue in order to give the court an opportunity to correct any error. In this case, it was obvious to the trial court that an error had occurred, and I can read to the court from the sentencing transcript when the Halbert decision was brought to the trial court's attention. The trial court stated, under those circumstances and taking into account Halbert, and Halbert does appear to address an issue we specifically argued in this case prior to trial, and if Halbert becomes controlling, I agree that it's not at the moment, and if Halbert becomes controlling, there's probably a very strong appellate right. So when the trial court read Halbert, the trial court was on notice, and it was obvious to the trial court that an error had occurred in this case. So even if the court applies plain error review, the error that occurred in this case was obvious and substantial because the trial court was on notice of that, of the error. And this court has no further questions, we would request that the court vacate the conviction in this case.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you an opinion in due course.